Jordan with 43. Malone is doubled. They swat at it and steal it. Here comes Chicago. 17 seconds. 17 seconds from game 7 or from championship number 6. Jordan open. Chicago with the lead.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Tuesday, May 19th. It is 9:08 out here on the West Coast. Just got done with a nice little round of golf, 18 holes at Loma Santa Fe Executive Course. I got Sleater in the background, so if there's any noise being made, you know, it's him playing poker with the boys. But joining me today, I mean, there's no one I'd rather have me, you know, no one I'd rather have on the podcast right now than my good pal, good friend of the show, producer, co-host Uncle Luke Domask. Uncle Luke, how we doing? How's been the start to the week been?
Been good, man. I mean, just finished up, a tough work week, but honestly, got Friday off and got Monday off, Memorial Day weekend. Gonna hit play some golf as well, and finally gonna clear up here in Chicago. But what a quarantine for the Chicago Bulls, man. I mean, not only the series that we're gonna get into here in a second, but new front office. Impending new coach, maybe a roster overhaul in the next 2 years. Like, I'm feeling good as a Bulls fan in ways I haven't felt since the turn of last decade in 2010 when Rose was the MVP. So I'm feeling good about this conversation we're about to have.
I'm not really sure what to think, but I do think there's change coming. And I think for the first time in 2 decades, maybe longer, that's just refreshing in itself. Like, I don't even know what their future holds. I don't know what the front office is going to exactly look like. I don't know what their starting five is going to look like next year, but change is coming. I think that's exciting. I mean, as a Bulls fan, what's the, outside of your opinion, what's kind of the hype in Chicago? Not that you're in sports bars or anything, but what's the hype around Chicago regarding their future?
You talking Bulls, obviously?
Yeah.
Obviously uplifting. Gar's finally gone, and I think this conversation kind of meshes into the conversation we'll have about The Last Dance and that documentary. But, Gar was hired by Jerry Krause after that team was, I want to say, taken apart, but, you know, it's forcefully ended, I guess you could say, for multitude of reasons we can talk about later. But Jerry Krause hires Tim Floyd as the coach and GM, and then eventually hires Gar Forman as the GM, and then John Paxson comes in later on and takes over from Krause. But, like, we just want to change, man. Like, we talked about this at the All-Star break when it was in Chicago. I was just like, I gave a very passionate outcry of just like, I'm done with this team until something happens. All I wanted was change in some format, and they go out and they hire Arturas Karnasovas and Mark Eversley from the 76ers, and two guys who are well respected around not just the league, but the world. I mean, the world of hoops, from not in just the United States, but across seas. Karnasovas is well versed with European basketball and knows a lot of people. And one of my favorite quotes I heard from Waj when all that went down was, he can walk into any gym in the world and he knows somebody there. And to finally have somebody who's leading your organization, that's the type of guy who's going to be leading the Chicago Bulls moving forward. I've got nothing but high hopes, and the rest of the city is the same way. We got what we wanted. We got change. It finally happened, and since that happened, I've been able to really enjoy this documentary, you know, because, like, had nothing been, you know, changed during all of this, I would still be like, oh yeah, this is all fun and games, but we're still going nowhere, right? I would have been using all this time and all my tweets basically on, yeah, but we still suck in the present. At least now I can at least, you know, make jokes, enjoy it, and have a good time and enjoy this whole documentary. So I it's hope, you know, and that's maybe one of the best words in sports, is just to have some sort of hope and optimism.
you know, at the end of the documentary, which we'll break down, and not even just the last two episodes, but really the podcast or the documentary as a whole, right? I just kind of like, now that we can see the whole picture of it, what are our thoughts and opinions? But I really thought what was interesting was the final 4 or 5 minutes of the documentary, right? We hear Jordan hits this last shot. Everyone knows about it. Everyone's seen the play 1,000 times in their life. But no one really knows what happened after that. And I still am not exactly sure really what happened after that. I've heard these myths of a large cut that was on Mike's hand from a cigar cutter that put
which
him
sounds
out of-
realistic. I mean,
from what we saw, the guy was smoking like 12 yeah. inch cigars for 6 times a day for an entire season, if not longer. So I've heard rumors of that. I've heard rumors, you know, that just Krause was going to break things up, that Reinsdorf eventually did give Phil Jackson, you know, the choice to come back if he wanted to. And Phil says, no, you would be going over Jerry, and Jerry doesn't want me here. But the final 30 seconds, the final minute, very Remember the Titans-esque. They went on to do this, this, and this. The Bulls started their rebuild, and they're still rebuilding. So I know you had a great tweet talking about that, but man, 25 years later or 20 years later, and to see that what they made at that time, the move they made at that time, still not being effective, you know, they won the battle. They maybe have the greatest dynasty of all time, but it seems to have cost them in some way or another since then.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, dynasties in general don't end well. You can see with the Patriots, you know, the past couple of months, Brady goes to Tampa Bay, Gronk follows him, and all of a sudden, you know, New England's sitting there with just Belichick, and I'm sure they'll be fine, obviously. But
of course they will be.
You know, I think, yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, that was about as clean of an ending to a dynasty as you could have. I am kind of on the, you know, maybe had I lived through the era, and I mean, I've talked about this with some of my Bulls fan, like Bulls buddies, as I used to call them, that, you know, had come out of the bushes, honestly, in the last 2 months, ever since Garpax, you know, got replaced. But I mean, I'm kind of the opinion that it was kind of time, you know, maybe obviously if had I, you know, lived through those 6 championships, I would have been greedy for a 7th, but at the same time, you saw in that game 6, Scottie's back wasn't hold up. He averaged 11.5 points the rest of his career. You know, he was an effective player in Portland and Houston from time to time, but he wasn't Scottie Pippen of the 90s that we know about. Phil was obviously drained. I mean, he went and took a year off in Montana. I mean, these guys played 100-plus games. Yeah, doing Phil things. Dennis plays
like,
35 games.
I'm
going to
just speculate. He was doing a lot of drugs in that one year in Montana.
Yeah, he was really enjoying himself. But, like, Dennis played 35 games after that. Kukoc wasn't himself. Longley was on his last few legs. So, I mean, overall, it was – oh, yeah, and then you had Mike, right, who I'm sure if you told, hey, Mike, we got to go 60 games with this lockout impending, and we're going to be playing night after night, can you carry this team that might have a Pippen that isn't Pippen anymore – and a roster that, for the most part, was kind of on its last legs heading into that game 6. I mean, they more or less should not have won. That Utah was the better team. Indiana was maybe the better team. I kind of would speculate with Reggie. I've watched that entire series. I don't know if, you know, they had good players on the Indiana roster, but I think
in
the
a
Bulls
funny
were still
way,
better.
In a funny way, though, maybe the 99 season was almost the perfect season for Mike to play the one extra year because of the limited number of games. Like, looking at an 82-game season, incredibly daunting task, especially considering, like you said, he's going to have to play every night. Maybe he looks at those 60, and I don't know if he knew at the time of his retirement whether or not there were going to be 60 games, but kind of an interesting thought. Kind of an interesting thought that it's a significantly less workload as opposed to the full regular season.
Right. I mean, but there is the opposite of that. So if you look at the timeline, he retires in January of 99. They started playing kind of around where the All-Star break started in 99. I mean, I'm of the opinion, I watched that. You remember the 2012 season. It was a shortened season, right? With the lockout and everything. And
I have, remember the lockout pickup game story?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what I'm trying to say is, like, Oklahoma City went to the finals that year, right? They were a really young team, and you know, those nights, those guys, those teams are playing four games in 5 nights to get games in. They were playing back to back to backs. I get that it was of Michael's DNA to play every freaking game possible. And I think that's, you know, obviously, like, the last 304 games he played of his career, where he played every single one of them. And it's a testament to him, but I just don't see how they could have handled that type of schedule. They needed the nights off in between games, or maybe just a couple of back-to-backs here and there. I think that shortened season would have really depleted them and really had to dip into their bench, which was pretty much non-existent for 97 and 98. I mean, they really were going seven guys rotation. Like, Scotty Burrell was a good player, but he was like a minus 19 in that game six against Utah in 98. Like, that was like their seventh best guy off the bench, right? And Ron Harper was on his last leg. They were all on their last legs. And I think it was just maybe, you know, obviously everyone wants to speculate. You play until, and Mike said it, you know, you play until you lose. You play until somebody beats you. I'm the champ until someone tells me otherwise, right?
And that's in all levels of basketball, not just the, you know, the pros. When you're playing pickup, you don't get off the court 6-0. That's not how that works. Right, yeah,
exactly.
You got to defend the turf.
Right. And so, I mean, I totally understand. I have an issue with the fact that, and this goes into the Gar Pax era, is they had a successor waiting. Like, Tim Floyd was going to be the guy. They knew that going into 99. It's the same thing when they fired Tibbs in 2015. Hoiberg was just, and they both came from Iowa State. It was just, that's the shit that gets under my skin and just boils my blood, is that these guys just, like, had things in place. And, like, Pax could have learned from Jerry not to do that. Does the same fucking thing, right? So, I mean, like, that's kind of the part where it gets a little messy. But overall, like, you wouldn't want to end the dynasty any other way, though. The steal, or excuse me, the bucket where he just drives past Russell. The steal on Malone where he waits to the perfect time all game. You know, I think that was maybe one of my favorite insights about that was he knew the entire game that they were, maybe the entire series of those 2 years. He knew that that play was constantly ran in crunch time. And he chooses the perfect moment to swat it away from Russell and hits the perfect, you know, the game-winning shot. I don't think we look at, if they lose in 99, and they say they bring everybody back for one more year in 99, and they lose in the playoffs. Like, that was a weird year. The Knicks made the finals as an 8 seed. The Spurs were a really good team that year as well, and they were a young team. So I don't think we look at it with such awe. You know, the game, the shot wouldn't mean anything as much, or wouldn't mean as much, I think, if the ban wasn't broken up after 98. So, I would definitely have a different opinion if I had lived through it. But
with that last play that you're talking about, so, you know, he gets the bucket, driving to the hoop. Then they set up the Malone post play, right? And as you said, Michael knew that that was going to come. They had been doing it the entire series, the entire season. I mean, he's played against Malone now for a decade, right? Like, yeah, he knows plus. This guy's game. What I find interesting is one of the things that Jordan always talks about, what separates him from other players and why he drafts certain players as opposed to others, is the size of his hands. Mm-hmm. That strip, a big factor in that strip is the size and strength of his hands, right? Just to get a paw on that ball as Malone is, you know, not keeping an eye on that baseline, and Jordan sneaks up behind him, takes a big swipe at the ball, knocks it out. Malone can't get a hold of it. It wasn't a clean steal, right? Like, it was a hit. Malone fumbles it a little bit and it's picked up. Then he obviously goes on to hit the last shot, blah, blah, blah. The rest is history. I think we have to start diving in here into the entire documentary here. So, I have a couple questions for you. Okay. And I have written down answers. I've got moments.
I've got a few questions as well, but this is good.
So when you walk away 10 hours, right? You've given a lot to this documentary, right? Time, energy, blood, sweat, and tears watching this thing.
Even before this, yeah.
Sure, right? And even the rumors of this doc being put together, the months leading up, there was like this bizarre, palpable energy being felt that, right, oh, we're getting the Jordan doc. Who's the big winner out of this? Who won the documentary?
You know, I want to say the mentality of Jordan, but I think I'll give. So I think the overall like this guy's different aspect. I think so. You know, I don't want to bring into the whole LeBron Jordan argument.
Just
into
the
this
spirit
podcast.
Of competition.
Yeah, I think just like why we play sports. Like sometimes we forget when we're watching the NBA, we're diving into analytics, we're diving into guys' true shooting percentages, that we forget like we're here to win the fucking game, right? We're not here to get drafts. We're not here to get draft picks. You know, we're not here to, you know, watch Joel Embiid play 25 minutes and then there's 5 minutes left in the game and it's a 2-point game and he has got to sit out because we're worried about knee injuries. I mean, it's just the fact that this guy was different. This guy was one of my favorite moments. I mean, episode 10 is just a masterpiece in the timeline of things. That last 5 minutes that we talked about in game 6 where he's sitting on the bench, he just viciously chewing at his gum and it's dead quiet and you kind of poke into the mind of what Mike is. Like, that's just incredible footage. But the music before game 1, right after game 7 in Indiana and they're going into Utah, and he goes, woke up, had a couple of beers, played the piano, smoked a cigar, came to practice. Like, that guy's just different. He just showed up and he gave it all every single night. And I think they really reinforced that. But I think an underrated aspect is Phil Jackson. I really do. I really think Phil, like, I found a greater appreciation for Phil. I, you know, growing up, you and I, we both know Phil as the Lakers coach. We know him with Kobe and Shaq, and then the second act with Kobe. And I've seen, you know, they used to do like these season documentaries of the former champion on ESPN. And they have one of the 2010 Lakers, I think. And that's when I really got to understand Phil. And I actually just ordered his book, Maverick, which kind of talks about his entire career leading up to coaching the Bulls and everything. But just like how this guy managed these personalities. Like, Michael is a different breed of human being. It's hard to coach that alone. Then you have Scottie, who could not have been more perfect for his role, and fit seamlessly, but at the same time was a complicated guy. He wanted that spotlight on him. You know, those 94 and 95 seasons, he was the guy, and he really wanted to show the world, like, hey, Mike was great, and I was great with Mike, but I'm great on my own, too. And then, of course, you have Rodman, too, right? Like, how he deals with Rodman, I think that's such an interesting storyteller, but, like, whenever the camera panned to Phil, I was just like, tell me more. How did you do this? And, like, one of the things I wanted to get off here is maybe we dive into Jerry Krause at some point, but Jerry Krause at one point had Doug Collins, Tex Winter, and Phil Jackson as his coaching staff. Went out and got all three of those guys almost simultaneously. Okay, Doug Collins coached for 20 years in the NBA, is a borderline Hall of Famer, played in the Olympics, everything. Phil Jackson's probably the best basketball coach of all time. Tex Winter is a genius of basketball. Went out and got all these guys at the same time. Like, the coaching staff is very underrated of this entire dynasty, and obviously Phil spearheads that. So I was always just, like, totally tuned in, wasn't reading Twitter or anything whenever Phil was speaking, because I was just enthralled with how he kept this all together, how he kept it fresh for these guys, the types of stuff he did in the locker room. Super interesting to me.
Couldn't agree with you more. It for me, it's obvious. There's no other answer. Starts, ends. It's Phil Jackson is the winner on this one. Since 2004, even longer after that, people have said, you know, Phil's a great coach, but he's had the luxury of this, this, and this. Oh, Phil's great. He's one of the best, but there's always a caveat that comes with the Phil Jackson conversation. I think this documentary erases all of that. To see what he was going through, to deal with Rodman, to deal with kind of a bitchy Pippen at time, like, sure. Pippen kind of got a little emo. Michael Jordan is as wild of a competitor as we've ever seen. He's got a dysfunctional GM above him and an owner who agrees with the GM. So Phil is the mastermind. He is the spider web keeping this entire organization together. For me, it's Phil Jackson. So, so easy. I was always kind of a proponent of, when you have Shaq and Kobe, things are great. When you got, you know, Michael and Pippen, yeah, sure, things are easy. The triangle offense, love it. Yeah, when you got Hall of Famers running it, of course it's going to work. This documentary changed my mind. I think Phil Jackson, I think the world of him right now. To see the way he was able to manage personalities and manage egos and manage emotions more than anything else. For him to understand the mind personality of Dennis Rodman is perhaps the most impressive thing on his resume. I don't know if anyone would have been able to do what he did. I don't know if Chuck Daly, right? the guy who fathered Dennis Rodman. I don't know if Chuck Daly was able to control and manage Dennis Rodman at this point in his career, but Phil was able to. Let's not forget, Dennis Rodman was wrestling in the WWE on a freaking finals night. Like,
Rodzilla.
Bro, you said you got that shirt, right?
Yeah, it's on its way. Yeah.
No, bro, that is so unbelievable. By the way, I watched that full match between Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman and Hulk Hogan. I'm really impressed with Karl Malone's skills. I inside the ring, not on the court,
Yeah, he
has a fantastic textbook body slam inside the squared circle of the WWE ring. I'm getting a little bit sidetracked here. Phil Jackson is the big winner of this thing. I don't think it's really even debatable.
Can I bounce off that before we move
go
on?
Go ahead.
You talked about. I'll name a few others. The security guards.
Oh my God, the behind the scenes
guys, Gus Lett and Michael Wozniak. I think was his name.
Sunshine.
Glorious mullet, curly mullet. I think those guys are big winners as well.
Sunshine.
Like his quote unquote entourage, Dolores Jordan. I think Michael's parents.
Yeah.
I don't think like people really realize how important. Your parents are that. I mean, especially for Michael. I mean, Michael looked up to his father, but his father was with him all the way through until his death, his tragic death in 94. I want to say or 93. Excuse me. So I think those are big winners there, but like those people have been winners for 25 plus years now. But I wanted to mention the Jerry thing. I think it was a good thing that Michael had a GM that kind of was always like, hey, Mike, like you are always on your, I'm always plotting my next move without you.
Yeah.
I think that really like, if you know, like, I've always thought like, cause a lot of people have been talking about what if the Bulls did this? What if Jerry Reinsdorf did this? What if Krause did this? And I'm kind of sitting here thinking the fact that they were somehow like doing all this and Michael and Scotty and all the and Phil all they knew about it, I think it drove them to just keep winning. Like what if they were in a perfect organization, right? What if they were in a perfect organization and things were just, you know, beautiful every single, like every day everyone's walking into work happy as a clam. I think this team just thrived in drama, thrived in, oh, okay, you think you're going to replace me? I'm fucking Michael Jordan. Like, I'll go win another championship. I don't care if Phil goes 82-0.
There's something to be said about the competitive nature of Jerry Krause himself. Because for a guy to be the unstoppable force versus the immovable object that is Michael Jordan, right? Like, one of the two has to break between the two. And Krause didn't. They went 6-0, quote-unquote. I know that's going to fire up Dustin. Quote unquote 6-0, right? With these finals. Mm-hmm. And Jerry's still thinking about the next move. He's still thinking about the next championship. How do we win the next one? How are we best prepared for that next one? Maybe he was the perfect yin to the yang that Michael was. I never really thought about that. I really like that, Luke. That's not bad.
I rewatched three and four last night, which are the Rodman episodes, but also
the two best episodes of the documentary.
Five and six are pretty good as well. Seven's good. We can discuss this later, but no, three and four are probably the most entertaining, without a doubt. Like that footage is super entertaining when they go to Vegas and everything. But it really because Michael really loved Doug Collins for those 3 years.
Yep. Yeah,
I mean Michael was Doug talks about it in the documentary. He goes, he was the MVP. He was the dunk champ. He was the defensive player of the year. He won virtually every single award you possibly could win without regard, not a championship, while he was coached under Doug Collins. And he loved playing for Doug. And the fact that Jerry Krause switches to Phil because they wanted to run the triangle with Tex Winter and everything, and that rubbed Michael the wrong way for the next decade, even though he loved Phil, absolutely adores Phil, wouldn't play for anybody else. The fact that Michael was just like, yeah, personal to me. Switched the coach that I liked on me. He's like, this is a fucking problem. I'm going to be pissed off about this. So, I mean, I think had he had a GM that he really liked, it maybe goes different. That's all. That's something I've been thinking about a lot.
Sleater's got a quick word he wants to throw in.
Yeah.
Let's hear it. Just curious about the relationship between MJ and Doug Collins. Because that's a little – they didn't cover it in the documentary, but – in 89, which was Collins' last year.
Yeah.
Jordan goes 5 of 15 in game 4, gets publicly criticized by the media, and Collins criticizes him for it. The next game, he plays 46 minutes, only takes 8 shots. They lose that game, lose the next game, and then Collins is – that's Collins' last series. So
– right.
I know the way that Collins talked about him and the way Jordan talked about Collins. I'm just curious.
Oh, I love you, Slater.
I'm curious.
Curious about what? Like, I mean, just
was their relationship as good as the documentary portrayed it to be?
I mean, I definitely think so. Like, I mean, he created the offense around Jordan. Like, it was a isolation offense. There's that scene in the documentary where Doug always tried to pit the practice against Michael in everybody else's favor.
Blowing the whistle.
Exactly. Yeah. And Michael walks out of practice, and then they kind of get over it and move on. Like, I think, like, Michael Jordan thrived off conflict, not with just his teammates, but his organization, his coaches. Like, he needed some sort of friction at all times. And obviously, you know, when I know that game that you're talking about in 89, and game 3 of that gate series is actually one of the greatest is also one of the greatest lines Doug Collins has, is the line where Michael takes over in the fourth quarter, hits it off the glass to beat Detroit to go up 2-1. And Doug Collins, and the reporter asked Doug Collins, what was the game plan coming out of the huddle there? It was get Michael the ball and everyone get the fuck out of the way. So, like, I mean, that was kind of the day-to-day thing of this entire organization for a decade, was one day it could be, you know, sunshines and rainbows, and the next day it seems like it's all falling apart, and they constantly kept it going.
Although they had even if they did have a bad breakup, right, Mike and Doug, I think at the bottom line, Mike appreciated that Doug handed him the keys. Like, no matter where the bus went, no matter if they fell off a bridge, no matter if they crashed into a tree, which they clearly didn't, they made an Eastern Conference Finals against, you know, one of the better teams in the history of the NBA and the Detroit Pistons. Right. Mike appreciated the trust that Collins gave to him. And I guess Collins, maybe in those public criticisms, was just saying, you know, we're handing the keys to Mike and he wasn't good enough tonight. And, you know, maybe it led to a bad breakup, but at the end of the day, Mike appreciated that he gave him the keys.
Yeah, kind of just playing devil's advocate more than anything
else. No, the timing of it
is more interesting to me than anything else. That happened to be his last series. Yes, maybe, you know, kind of a just a coincidence of a time period. Like a Mark Jackson, Steve Kerr type thing, where it was just time. Mm-hmm. Like, Mark Jackson didn't lose that series against the Clippers in 14, but it was just time for him to move on and for Kerr to come in. So, more playing devil's advocate, the timing is just really interesting to me.
Right, and I mean, like, they asked Michael, like, what he thought of the change from Doug Collins to Phil Jackson, and Michael was upset. So I think there was always that respect and admiration for Mike and Doug, and so I think, you know, obviously they had their ups and downs, but it's definitely a good question to ask.
So we just broke down, you know, our big winner, and we both came to the agreement that Phil Jackson comes out of this thing smelling like roses.
I mean, Michael too, but like that would just be
of course, but I think a lot of people would not necessarily argue that he was the big winner of this. So who's the loser? Who comes out looking the absolute worst from this documentary?
I think gut reaction for a lot of people is Pippen. I think a lot of people were just like, you know, I don't think a lot of people know about that story against the Knicks in 94.
Yeah.
Like I did. Yeah. Like, I've seen that game a bunch of times. Like, I knew, and two coach hits that still. And I think one of the best stories is Melissa Isaacson, who covered the Bulls in that time. She's a reporter, covering the Bulls at the time, was always like following Michael around, like one of the Brian Windhorst of the Michael Jordan era, if you will. And Michael was in the clubhouse and he sees that Scotty, you know, isn't going back in. He goes, Kukoc is taking this, is going to make it. Like that was just ridiculous that he just like threw that in. I would say a lot of people would say Scotty. You could say Jerry Krause, but like there had to be somebody.
If Krause doesn't get a voice, then he can't be the big loser in this, right? Like, I think anyone could be painted in a certain light when they don't have a voice, they don't have a say in things. But
right. I mean, Jerry put this all together. Like, Jerry's a Hall of Famer.
No matter what, you know, he's holding up the six just like Mike is.
Yeah.
Right?
Nobody's
like, he's
really
still holding up the six
yeah.
rings.
It's tough to say anybody of this who was on the Bulls is a real loser when you win six rings or three rings. Scotty Burrell, maybe, but even then he was such a nice guy about it. I have one more for you. Go ahead, because I don't really have one. Like, I have a hard time like saying like all this publicity and all this like looking back. If you're still relevant 25 years later, how are you losing at some point? You know what I mean? So go ahead.
For me, it's easy, and it's someone that I've had a lot of respect for over the last 20 years. Honestly, like, spent a lot of time consuming this person's work. Michael Wilbon has been an idiot for the last 5 weeks. Like, I've literally lost respect for the man. He has been so delusional about the entirety of the Chicago Bulls. Like, listen, I'm here to tell you that Mike's the GOAT, right? Like, as of right now, Mike is the greatest basketball player to ever play. The Bulls are the greatest dynasty ever built in the history of basketball. So, like, let's understand that that's the baseline. And Wilbon has been just absolutely delusional. He has talked down people, saying that players now wouldn't dominate like they would, or they would not dominate like they do now if they played in the 80s or 90s. In every realm, in every industry, in every profession, people get better, more efficient, and just like smoother in every line of work. That's the case. Mm-hmm. And for Mike Wilbon to not accept that, like, dude, he just sounds old and grumpy and stubborn.
It's been his bit of shtick for a while. Not even just in baseball.
And maybe you're right. And maybe I just never recognized it because I wasn't, alive for this 90s Bulls era. And so I wasn't hearing him talk about it. But, oh my God, it has been brutal. It's like nails on a chalkboard for me listening to Michael Wilbon talk about the Chicago Bulls lately. It has been really, really bad. And it's someone, honestly, that I respect, so it's kind of a bummer. Okay, next question for you. Makes you think Dennis Rodman, this absolute psychopath, worker, efficient, ball player, does everything right. Off the court, he's a little bit of a head case. But he was in the right situation with the right coach, the right other players surrounding him. Who's another player that maybe wasn't in the right situation, was considered a head case, was considered a wild card, but if he had been in a different location, in a different organization, different franchise, different teammates, would have thrived and succeeded and potentially had found the same success that Rodman found?
Just throughout the course of the NBA of the last 20 years?
Yeah, last 20 years, I guess.
I'll give you a really good example. Is Ron Artest was probably... Yeah. You followed a very similar timeline, right?
Yeah, a lot of similarities too.
So gets in the malice at the palace and is the main figure there. Gets suspended for the rest of the year, and then comes back and accepts his role with the Lakers in his later half of his career after going up against Kobe. Very similar how Rodman and Jordan like played against each other and guarded each other. Like Rodman and Jordan guarded each other, Rodman guarded Jordan. And then, Artest and Kobe, same sort of deal, become teammates, they make up, and he accepts his role. And Artest hits one of the biggest shots of the Lakers in 2010 in Game 7 against the Celtics. Like, and it's the same sort of deal. Like, I need to trust you right now. And Kobe makes the pass and Artest. So I would say Artest. So the thing about, like, head cases, like, no, everybody today is so freaking polished, right? Like, guys come to the NBA, they're 19 years old. And, like, the biggest thing they can screw up, it gets posted on social media and, we kind of get over it, we move on, whatever. But, like Jason Tatum, for example, comes out of Duke 1 year, 19 years old, and he's carrying
himself
like a 12-year and playing,
like, vet in the league.
Exactly. Donovan Mitchell, same way. Ben Simmons, very similar. Yeah. Like, all these guys, Trae Young even, Ja Morant, like, these guys are saying the right thing over and over, and they're so well manicured that it's tough to think of, like...
Can I spitball two at you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Please.
And maybe not even necessarily like right now, but 10 years ago, perhaps. For a long time, DeMarcus Cousins was viewed as this bully, mean guy, not a winner, selfish, couldn't stay focused on the game, and eventually like let personal drama inside of games defeat him. But I'm starting to watch this, and the way Phil Jackson was able to treat Rodman. If you had put DeMarcus Cousins in replacement of Shaq on the Lakers, I know this is saying a lot. Maybe they don't win three in a row, but I think Phil Jackson is able to manage the mind of DeMarcus Cousins. And then the other person that I'm going to throw out there, Dwight Howard, right? Like, Dwight Howard's kind of been viewed as this flim-flammy guy. He's got these weird, like, off-the-court stories, was always super talented, then struggled with back pain. But I'm starting to wonder, like, if those two had found the right home and the right organization, the right city that embraced them and loved them for who they were, I wonder if they would have been able to find kind of a similar role to Rodman, where it's just rebound, defend, get the ball to the right guy. That is all you have to do, and just show up on game day. Like, as long as you work, that is all that matters. You know, the Rodman role is really interesting.
Maybe I'm remembering wrong, but I don't remember a time when those guys, you know, when Pippen or Jordan or any of the teammates looked at Rodman as a bad teammate. You know,
yeah.
Boogie and Dwight have a clear history of multiple guys. You know, obviously Dwight on the Lakers currently has really, you know, resurrected his reputation.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
He's played really well. So maybe Dwight is kind of changing that narrative per se, but, and, you know, Boogie maybe a little bit as well, but Rodman was was a great teammate. You know, like, he did a lot of things on the court that a lot of guys never wanted to do. He would get in opponents' faces, and he would piss, you know, he'd get everybody else off their game. Like, even in that last play, like, Dennis Rodman was not guarding Karl Malone well. They didn't show it at all, but if you watch that, it was entire 97 and 98. Like, the Bulls never had an answer for Karl Malone. And, like, Dennis guarded him.
The clip of Rodman and Malone getting tangled up in the backcourt tripping over each other.
Slapping each other's asses, yeah.
Bro,
yeah.
Like, that was so Dennis Rodman, and it was so harmless. Like, in reality, right, of all the things that you could do wrong on a basketball court, that was so harmless, and I just know how much that bothered Karl Malone at the time.
Mm-hmm. I do have a question for you.
Yeah.
So, who's your favorite, like, background character that you didn't know about going into the series that you came out of it just like, I loved everything about that? Who, like, okay. It could be, like, anything.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we'll get into it. Steve Kerr had a great final episode. Like, just
yeah, Steve had a really,
amazing.
I think it was 9, right? Want to say it was 9?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I'm bunching them together.
Of course.
Amazing. You texted me, and you're right. BJ Armstrong. Like, I just love that guy, bro. And the fact that he hit a game winner over MJ and just, like, gave him that death stare, even though, of course, they don't win the series, right? Like, Charlotte had no business competing with those Bulls. But the fact that, like, he had to give it to him a little bit.
And he knew what he was doing.
Oh, of course he did. Are you kidding? He was his teammate for, you know, almost a decade. Of course he knew what he was doing. I don't know if this is a soft answer. Scott Burrell, for him to take the verbal beating that Jordan was giving him and to wear all of it with a smile and to continue to show up every day to work and work hard and be a contributing member of the team, there's a little bit of admiration I have for him, because Mike's not easy to play with, right? Like, I think the most famous quote of this is, if you don't want to play that way, don't play.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have to. Burrell knew that, but he still wanted to. He knew what the end result would be. He knew that holding that championship trophy would mean more at the end of it. It would taste sweeter if he was able to go through those ups and downs during the season. So many people, especially nowadays, right? Like, if there's a teammate that's bullying him, and I'm not even talking about at the NBA level, right? At the high school level, if the best player on the team is kind of bullying one of the weaker players, that weaker player doesn't show up the next season. They're
transfers.
Done.
Like,
say
in high school, college, high school, college, like, everybody's got options nowadays. They're transferring. They're going to different places.
Of course.
In the NBA today, like, it's not even frowned upon almost anymore for a guy to be like, I want out. Like, trade me. And then all of a sudden everybody's like, you know, the Photoshop kings, like, start putting jerseys on you. Like, it turns into an entire PR stunt if you get asked for a trade. Like, there used to be a time in the NBA where if you got asked for a trade, you're like, the hell's wrong with you, right? So,
I don't know. I think Scott might be my answer on this one. I just
okay
for his level headedness was really impressive throughout the entire documentary. Yeah.
I mean, I know I've already mentioned the security guards, but Tim Glover, who was the trainer for, has maybe one of the most emotional, like out of almost nowhere. I think it was seven or eight, which were definitely the most emotionally charged episodes of the 10, where he's talking about, like, I think it's when Michael comes back, right, and they lose to the Magic, and like. Tim goes up to him and is like, Michael, tough series. Let me know when you want to get after this again. And Michael goes, I'll see you tomorrow morning. And if you're a trainer, like if you've met like a personal trainer or guys who are just really into like fitness and getting after every day, you know that like deep down that was the one answer that Tim would have wanted to hear from Michael. And I'm sure he knew it was coming from Michael. But like he has that quote where he's just like, this guy gave it his absolute all for every single minute he was a professional basketball player. And it wasn't just on the court, but it was after. And they talk about the Space Jam routine, how he had no idea where he found the energy. Like, I come out of this, I'm just like, wow, like what a special guy. And like his backstory is incredible, how he like became like trusted by Michael. He used to count Michael's steps. He would watch the game and count Michael's steps. And then like this is back in the 80s. And he's just like, hey, Mike, this is how many steps you took. Let's try and like work on, you know, body conservation throughout games so you can play more minutes and play more games. And like, I mean, that quote, I obviously didn't know anything about him until this series. But that the quote where he gets a little emotional about Michael bringing it every single night because he didn't know who was, you know, watching him for the first time, I thought was one of the more powerful, you know, insights into why Michael was so good.
Okay, so I got to do this real quick, okay? And I'm hoping you take the anti approach because I loved the 10-part documentary, loved it. Right, enjoyed every Sunday night for the last 5 weeks. I've loved it. But I wanted to point out a few things that should have been done differently. Okay. I have to, right? Like, come on.
No documentary's perfect. No documentary's perfect.
So let's start. It's not a documentary.
Okay.
It's an autobiography. And those are two very different things.
Sure.
Did you watch the Defiant Ones? The hip hop.
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
Loved it, right? Absolutely ate it up. Dre, perfect, Snoop, Kendrick, like some of my favorite and biggest influences in music are those.
Well, that's
guys
just hip hop. You're not even talking about the Beatles and Fleetwood Mac and all the other,
which are in the earlier episodes. But just personally for me, as a hip hop West Coast kid, like,
right,
ate it up. It meant a lot to me. But when I watched it, I knew that those guys had the final cut on it, right? Like, you had to know that what was being said about Dre and what was being said about, you know, the producers during the NWA days and the guys that were telling them, no, and you're not allowed to do this. Oh, but you guys need to abide by your contract. You said you were gonna do two more albums. We're just hearing it from their side. And I really think that, like the Defiant Ones, which I loved and I've watched now five times, it's a lot like that. This is branded work. This is a Jordan produced documentary. And I just hope that people don't necessarily take what was being said about certain people as the absolute truth. And I think even today, I think Horace Grant kind of popped off a little bit today saying that, you know, not necessarily all of this is true. This is just from Michael's perspective of how things went, but this is not necessarily like, right? And I say this a lot. Three sides to every story, right? One side, the other, and somewhere in the middle is the truth, right? Like, your perspective can be heavily altered based off the emotions. And Mike himself has admitted to changing things in his head to motivate himself. So I don't know if I necessarily take Michael as this super reliable source on these different topics, different moments in his life. He was also facing a lot of trauma, a lot of pressure. His father passed away. Like, I don't know if I'll be the same when that happens eventually, right? I don't know if I'll be the same for that year. So I just, at times for me, it felt like they gave us a cookie and I loved the cookie. I ate it up. I like one of the best tasting cookies I've ever had, but I wanted the whole jar. And it felt like they just held a lot of it off to the side. They dangled the cookie, and we loved it.
What parts?
Okay. And not that this is an indictment on Jordan as a father, but we didn't hear anything about his wife. We barely heard from his kids. I would love to know Michael's thoughts on... Oh, let me just... One thing, and then you can hop in. Did Michael want his sons to reach the same level of fame and same level of success as himself? Right? When they were playing college ball, they were faced with this tremendous amount of pressure, these ridiculously high expectations that no one could obtain. I wonder if deep down he did not want his kids to go through the same thing that he went through. I wonder if his divorce, and again, this is a personal question, but once you're a public figure like this, like, people want to know these kind of things. Did his divorce have something to do with, I don't know, gambling, with his high levels of intensity during the work year, bizarre habits on and off the court? Like, I wonder if that had a strain on his marriage. Can you reach the level that Michael was able to reach without sacrificing other parts of your life? It made it seem very fine and dandy. I think they were able to give us moments of him being a rough teammate, right, to Steve Kerr hitting him in the face. They were able to show, like, yes, he lost to the Magic. Parts of it they didn't necessarily show. They showed the father's passing. They don't show the Wizards years at all. And I know this is a documentary about the 97-98 season, but this is a Michael Jordan documentary. They don't show about his time as a Bobcats owner. Michael, you know, after going through your years as the Bobcats owner, do you have any, like, different opinions on Kraus and Reinsdorf? Like, knowing how hard it is to run and manage and organize a team and organize a franchise, is it as easy as you thought it was when you were on the court? Like, not everyone is like Michael. It is very easy for Michael to go out on a court, be himself, dominate a game. But not everyone else is going to do that. And I think Kraus and maybe Reinsdorf had a bigger picture on things than Mike was able to. And then after I wrote down all these different gripes that I had, I put, no matter what, would it have been enough? Right? Like, no matter what, if they had given us another 10 hours and even more information, would I have walked away being even more hungry, saying, oh, I wish they had still shown this? So maybe there's no right answer, but I still felt like this was a branded piece of, like, minor propaganda, much less than a documentary where Jason gets to control the entire narrative of him trying to tell the truth.
Okay, so a whole lot you went through there. So keep me on track as I try.
I got it all written down here. So, and not all of it's necessarily right, but I just wanted to bring up the points. At least.
Good points. They're really good points. I mean, there were the lows in Michael's career that were showed in this documentary were not always portrayed.
Yeah.
You know, they lost to the Pistons twice. They only talk about 1 year where they lose to the Pistons.
Yeah.
He loses multiple times. You know, he almost plays 7 years before he even gets to the Eastern Conference Finals, which is almost as similar to LeBron James as can be. I think so. To note on the whole propaganda thing. Sure, I mean, it definitely felt like, look, I'm a Bulls fan. This is what I grew up consuming as much as possible. I think at some point you have to make the argument that the director, Jason here, had to make the executive decision, like, I'm not going to pull any punches with you on the questions. At the same time, I know that because I have you, I have to kind of let you have final say. I will say, I've watched all of his interviews that he's done after these, you know, with Jalen and Jacoby, with Scott Van Pelt.
Sure.
He's been everywhere.
Dan Patrick, yeah, Ringer.
Exactly. He's literally been everywhere. And multiple times he's been asked, you know, once you showed Michael Jordan the documentary, did he take anything out? And every single time he says no. So whatever they put together and edited, you know, Michael said no. No, now that doesn't mean that might be an indictment on just the editing process or just like what they decided to put in. But at the same time, you only have so much time period. Like, you have 10 hours, but it's not realistically 10 hours. It's about 55 minutes per episode.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So you only have so much to get in. Look, about the Wizards years, honestly, man, like, if you know about the Wizards years, they just weren't that interesting. He comes back and he plays.
They are interesting, though. They are interesting.
I mean, like what do you want to know? Like,
when you're the most fascinating, perhaps the greatest player of all time, the question of, did you come back one too many times? It's a really important question. So many athletes, so many people struggle with, when is it time to hang it up? And Michael could have given us a very straightforward answer that I think I personally would have appreciated.
Okay. I mean, yeah. I mean, like, it's the same thing. I'm looking at a Brett Favre jersey right now. Like, I mean,
yeah.
The question of, like, great players who can continuously just keep going and keep going until their body literally breaks down. I mean, I just never found the, like, even, I remember the Wizards.
Muhammad Ali came back too many times.
Right. That's just like the competitive streak in those guys that makes it so much different than us. You know, like you and I, like we're just, they're just different breeds of human beings.
Yeah.
So I think I'm trying to remember all your points. So you had,
and then the time is the director's owner, just the alternate perspective of, now that you're done playing, you've experienced time in the front office. Do you have a little more sympathy for the way Krause and Reinsdorf handled things?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do feel the ending was maybe
I'm literally asking you like you're Michael right now, by the way.
I feel very pressured because sometimes I feel like I'm carrying the Chicago Bulls narrative on my shoulders. Yeah, I know.
That's why you're here. You're the Bulls guy. Come on.
It would be interesting to hear. I've tried my best to learn as much about Jerry Reinsdorf without having met him as humanly possible, and he's a tough cookie to crack, man. Like, he has done many times in his career to say one thing, kind of move the goalpost a little bit to the point where you're like, okay, I get it. But at the same time, you're like, but are you lying to me? Are you fucking with me? Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's done that many times in his career. The man made his money off real estate, made the absolutely incredible business savvy move to buy the Bulls right the year after Michael gets drafted. So a year, Michael's rookie year happens. He sees this incredible opportunity to buy the Bulls for $9 million freaking dollars. You can't find houses for $9 million, and he bought the Bulls, and they're now on $3 billion. Like, you have to give the man some credit in some respects.
Yeah.
No doubt was Michael thinking such small minded of, like, I just want to keep winning championships. And Jerry were both thinking, by the way, if I had a field day with Gar Pax, imagine the hashtags I would have had with Jerry and Jerry. Are you kidding me?
Oh my god.
We'll skip past it. But, like, it would be interesting to I think a lot of it just was, it came down to, this is about the 90s Bulls. This is about an era, a period of time from 1990, you know, or I wouldn't say from 1990, but technically from 1991 to 1998, where they win 6 championships in 8 years. And it was about that, and it wasn't about the Wizards, and it wasn't about the his ownership now. Obviously, he's not run the Hornets in a particularly astounding way since he's become full, you know, control owner of them.
Yeah.
Those questions are interesting, but at the same time, like, when you have Michael Jordan, the guy opens up. The last thing I wanted to say about this, I read a quote today, how his father, you know, he would talk, or he would do interviews, and people would say, I would speak to Mr. Jordan or Michael's dad for 3 hours, and he would not give me any family secrets or any sort of family ties or anything. And Michael was the same way. You could speak to him hours on end about all types of different topics, and he would be invested, he would be present, he would answer everything to the best of his abilities, but he just wouldn't give you things about his personal life or certain things. I know for a fact I watched his sons play basketball. Like, I watched them play high school basketball. Yeah. They weren't that good. I mean, they were good players. They made it to high school. But I think a lot of it was just based off of their father. Like, they're, you know, and, like, now they run the Jordan brand. Like, they're the guy, the people who are in there every day running the Jordan brand.
They're businessmen
and women. They're very successful human beings. And have made names for themselves outside of their father. It was a little interesting just to see them pop in for the Jazz, like, fan thing. I totally agree. Keep them in or keep them out. But it was a funny quote. Like, they made the most of it. Like, it was just like, we heard different things in Utah than we would hear anywhere else. And, like, it was just like, that was kind of a funny jab at Utah fans. But, I mean, and Indiana fans as well. But I would have been interested to, because you see them in the 98 timeline. You see them all the time in the background and everything. So, you know, When you're the director, so I studied documentary film in college, like, that was whatever. When you get that type of interview, and Michael doesn't do a lot of interviews, like, one every probably 3 years, it seems sometimes, it's really tough to A, get to him, and then when you have him, to, like, keep him interested and invested. And, like, they got as about as close or as much as you're ever going to get out of Michael Jordan. Like, they talk about his father's, you know, killing. Murder. You know, they talk, yeah, murder. They talk about literally almost everything in that time span. And I've studied that timeline about as well as a 24-year-old kid to date who didn't get to experience all of it could, right? And I was still learning a ton of different backstories and everything. It's interesting, the whole propaganda, because I see it. I see if you're not a Bulls fan or if you're somebody just watching it and you're like, okay, like, I want to see, like, another side to this. The Horace stuff is interesting because Horace has always been that type of guy. Who is always, because he was the one to leave, play with the Magic, go head to head. He beat the Bulls. He gets carried off in the United Center. I mean, there's always been friction between Horace and the rest of the organization. Now Horace is around. He's a commentator on NBC
Relatively
Chicago.
Vocal.
He's very vocal. Like he's there with the present day Bulls. And Scotty isn't around. Michael obviously isn't around. Like Horace is one of the last few guys of the 90s without, you know, Will Perdue and Wennington does the radio. He's one of the last, like, notable guys who's around all day, every day, regarding today's generation of the Bulls. So the Jordan rules will always be, like, a very interesting point because Sam Smith, if you've ever read the book, like, Sam Smith, like, really just gets in there. I mean, he mentions it. He got death threats. He couldn't go to work for a week because people in Chicago were just pissed at him. Why would you drop this book in the middle of us winning all the time? It's a different era, and I wanted to note on this, like, you know, because people are just like, we need a 10-doc or 10-part series about this or 10-part. Not everything needs 10 parts.
No, it doesn't.
Not everything is interesting in 10 parts. And I know, like, there's going to be some sort of LeBron James, you know, documentary of some sort in the next 30 years or whenever he decides to actually.
It will be just as branded towards LeBron as this one will be.
I think it's going to be significantly different because we don't get to see the day-to-day life of Michael Jordan. I get to see 30 Instagram stories about LeBron James every single day if I want to, right? Like, I know who LeBron James is as a person without ever having met him. There's a lot of things people did not know about Michael Jordan even going into this, and he's been in the public conscious for 40 years now. So, there are things that come out of this. The one thing that bothers me the most, and it has for the last 10 weeks, but I knew it was coming, was just like people are watching this and being like, okay, but LeBron does this. Like, when in society did we just get to a point where we can't sit down, be present, and just enjoy the fucking thing? Why does everything have to turn into an argument on Twitter about who's the greatest of all time? Why? I've entertained this argument a billion times and I'll argue it as many times more. But it just bothers me, and I knew going into it was going to be the thing. From literally episode one, it was like, it was the rebuttal. Like, hey, just give it up for a second. And it's not just from LeBron fans, it's from Jordan fans as well.
Yeah.
It's just give it up. But I know that's the nature of how we live today. So I get it. But
both
just,
sides have been just as ludicrous as the other. I don't think the LeBron stands have been any worse than the Jordan.
It's really the Joker versus the Batman. They need each other, right?
Dude,
it's that scene in the interrogation room. It's like, you need me. And like Batman doesn't deny it. Like doesn't kill him in that scene where he's flying down on the Batmobile and everything. Like, you know, LeBron and Jordan fans need each other. Give me some of your favorite like scenes overall in episode 10 that we kind of wrap, come towards the conclusion here. Like, I have one takeaway or like one thing that I learned that I definitely didn't know about Michael that I thought was maybe one of the more illuminating things, and then just like a natural takeaway away. But like, give me some things that like you watched it and you're like, oh my God, like this is awesome. Like, this is a hoops head, is someone who enjoys hoops content like us. Like, what were some of the episodes or scenes that you really enjoyed?
I mean, I guess now we can get into it. Steve Kerr's willingness and preparation leading into that shot. You see it in the clip 1,000 times, right? All right, Mike, if they double team, you know, I'll be ready for it. I'll be ready. A lot of guys say it. A lot of guys maybe think it. A lot of guys wish they did think it. Very few are willing and able and capable of stepping up in a moment like that.
Can I jump in real quick just for a second?
Of course.
I know we already talked about it earlier, and it just came to my mind now about who won. In my eyes, in my heart, now that he's gone, or just in the background. John fucking Paxson, dude, was such a baller. Like, I've watched a lot of games since all of this. Like, watched a lot of full games. I'm just like watching this guy. I was like, had I watched John Paxson play basketball, I would have been like running sprints for him. Just like I thought he was such an incredible. Like, he makes so many big shots. Steve the same
big
way.
Winner,
I mentioned that
the big winner in this is whatever movie theater that John Paxson was sitting in during the interview. I want to watch Bulls games in that movie theater with
Paxson. The Bulls, that's where they watch their film. It's the new Advocate Center. Yeah, it's so sick. Yeah, I know.
Oh, other big winner. The 97-98 warm-ups with the giant Bull logo on the back, bro. I mean,
all red.
That's as good as any like bikini I've ever seen.
No, I'm sick of seeing these like very thin, small bikinis on Instagram models. Why don't you suit up in the all red,
on.
97 Bulls? That's a good one. Keep going. Steve Kerr and all that. I'm sorry to get you sidetracked for a
second. I guess I can't really emphasize it enough. So many guys say that they're ready to hit that final shot. They practice the shot hundreds of thousands of times in their life, ready to hit a shot like that. And Kerr, despite, early friction with Jordan, right? Like, clearly it came to a head, but Mike appreciated the competitive level. And without that moment, maybe Michael doesn't truly believe Steve when he says, "I'll be ready." Maybe without that moment where Kerr does push him in practice, maybe Mike doesn't believe him when he says that. And he doesn't give up the ball and he takes a forced 16 to 17 foot floating jumper instead of dishing it and making the right play to Steve Kerr. Okay, so I was able to meet Steve Kerr on a couple different occasions. He's a San Diego guy, met his kids numerous times. Hold up. You'll like this.
For the podcast listeners, he's showing me something here. Yeah. Dude, that scene was literally in the scene. So what he's showing me right now is a picture of Steve Kerr shooting free throws, the exact same scene where he's like shooting free throws in the Birdo Center. And it's signed and it says, "Good luck, Bo," signed Steve Kerr. That's so sick.
Okay, so I was able to meet Steve Kerr. He was in San Diego. We were watching San Diego State Aztec game in like 2011, maybe 2010-ish. It was like Kawhi Leonard's sophomore or freshman year. He was not the player that he was, obviously, today. But there were rumblings that the kid could be pretty good. We went with a group. Steve was sitting in front of us. And we're behind one of the hoops. And I'm obviously not trying to bother him the whole time. But watching the shot, it's so vivid now what he told me, right? I asked him one thing, "Hey, I'm heading into, I think, my freshman year of basketball. Love the game. What's one tip for a kid who wants to be a good shooter?" He said, "Balance. When you shoot, have really good balance." And he practices what he preaches, because on that final jumper, when he hits the big shot, man, both feet are under him. The rhythm's And it was as pure as ever, man. So, yeah, I mean, Steve Curry, he's a North County kind of guy. And I don't know. I was in absolute love with the entire story that he was able to put on it. And despite at times I'm annoyed by his political, like, not even views, just like the voice. Like, I don't really care what he thinks. Despite being annoyed at times.
You know where it comes from now.
Like, he is from a family that has lived it. Like, he has a worldly view on things. He has a very wide perspective. Like, at least now, like, hopefully people understand the resume that comes behind him when he says political
well-educated
things. Like, so when he says things like he does, like, yeah, well, maybe he has a voice for a reason. Something they didn't get into. Do you know the Arizona State story?
Yes. After he, so my dad went to Arizona. Both my parents went to Arizona. We're huge Lute Olson stands, but when he's in Phoenix playing Arizona State, and there's like the fan base is like giving him shit about his dad's death, which is no less than like four weeks away or whatever. Go ahead and tell the story if you want.
No. I mean, that's exactly the story. But as a college kid, right? To go through that, not even to go through that.
But his family's not even with him, right? They're in Beirut, like his mom and his brother.
He turns to basketball as his escape, right? Like his mom said it. Nowhere else to go. So what do? He turned to basketball and he put all his energy into basketball. And in the one place where he did put his energy, he's getting shit there too about his pops, right? Mm-hmm. For him to go through that, you know, I think maybe that's what helped build the tough exterior and maybe allowed him to have a successful career moving forward and like
championship DNA,
right? Like you got to be able to wear it at times. And that's in a lot of different professions, but I mean, professional sports more than anything else, you got to be able to wear it, right? You got to have thick, tough as fuck skin, like, excuse my language, but like you got to be able to bring it and wear it. So I was just really impressed with the entire Steve Kerr story. And I know that was only episode 9, not episode 10, but just really, really blew my mind.
Yeah. I mean, this is the first time we've extensively talked about it. We really haven't been texting at all during any of this. You know, we did the podcast a couple of weeks ago. So this is really the first time we've talked about any of them. For me, I thought one of the more illuminating experiences, or stories comes from Mark Vansel, who was the co-author with Mike of Rare Air. And so a lot of like the stuff I know about, like people ask me like, you know, how come you know so much about Michael Jordan and watched him play or anything? I've just read the books. I've consumed all the content humanly possible. But he has a quote, he has a thing and his that I just thought was so interesting and like important in today's society, but also in today's sports and landscape and everything, how present Michael was as a human being, right? That he was like, you know, there was something with the Zen Buddhism that Phil got through to Michael about living in the present. You know, I think athletes in general are just like these types of people who need that sort of like mental task list of like, got to wake up, go to practice, you know, lift this, that game time. Like they're naturally habitual human beings, right?
Yeah.
I think you can, you can definitely get caught up if you're, you know, very few athletes are as popular as have reached popularity like Michael Jordan on a global scale.
Not even
athletes.
Yeah. Humans in general.
Exactly. Right. And for him to like, when Vansel says like how to get that glimpse of like how present he was, like, and I think that quote when he's on the piano with his friends and he's celebrating in his at the Jordan Bar, as he calls it, in his hotel room after they win in game 6, how he's just like, no, I'm not worried about next year, like, let's enjoy this right now, let's live in the present. It's like, and like even talks about, you know, going into game 1, he's so laid back, he's been there before, but he understands the task at hand. He never worries about a shot that he hasn't taken yet, like those types of things are just such, like, if I was still in high school or if I was playing, you know, a collegiate sport right now, like this shit would inspire so much out of me to hit the gym and be like just, but the whole present thing, like I think today's society, we're always, we have so much anxiety about things we cannot control. And for Michael to hear that about Michael Jordan being like, this guy was never playing a game that he could not control, was never, you know, gambling in something in an outcome he could not control. Or have some play of controlling. I thought it was super interesting.
Some of my favorite Michael moments, and we're going to wrap this up here, okay? Some of my favorite Michael moments throughout the entirety of this was not in the interviews. It's when he was in the locker room and you could hear the North Carolina Southern voice.
Yeah.
Like, not the Nike PR machine guy. Not the ESPN documentary guy, not the Jordan brand shoe like mogul, not the owner of an NBA team, not the greatest player of all time. I'm talking about the North Carolina kid that like every now and then you would hear that Southern twang where he'd be like, oh, hell no, Scott Burrell. Like the way he would just like say hell nah or something, like,
yeah,
I don't know. Those were the moments that I really seemed to appreciate because that felt so authentic to me.
I really enjoyed like anything after, like post game, they're wearing those big ass suits.
Yeah.
Like, him, Hart. I know I've mentioned it before, but like when they're sitting, like the training room was apparently where these guys hung out because it was the only place they could get away. It was the only place these guys could get away from the media because it was constant, right?
Sure.
And not even just the media, but just fans trying to get into places they couldn't normally get into. But just like them hanging out in the, like after games, smoking cigars and drinking Miller Lights. You hear about guys going into like hyper chamber, like cold chambers all the time.
Yeah. And
there's no doubt Michael spent a ton of money on his body to continuously keep doing this year after year, just like LeBron. But I have a hard time believing guys after games are having some Miller Lights and cigars today. Right.
It's not
and it's just like
anymore.
that's where it's like that's a different breed, man. Like,
yeah,
if we're going to like if you're going to give the greatest of all time all that modern day technology, does he even still use it? Like, I'm good. I'm going to take my cigar. And this is how I unwind. And like, hey, you want to talk about winners? Miller Lights. Huge winner.
Oh, my God. Huge winner.
Cigars?
I think the cigar.
I swear to God, when I go and play on Thursday and Friday, I'm going to be smoking cigars. Like I wanted to smoke a cigar post. I am 100% back in on cigars. I haven't been since like high school. But yeah, I mean, just like let's wrap it up. What's your just give me your quick last takeaway? Like what's you know
this is one of the. This was the best time it could have really come out. Like, honestly, with everything that's going on right now and all the bullshit that everyone is going through, like, these escapes on Sunday nights it just felt so normal. Like, the normalcy was absolutely back. And there was also a little bit of, how do I want to say this? At times, I really just felt like a kid again. Like the way I was just watching these games, like, I don't even know maybe it's just because, like, I've gotten into the sports journalism industry and not to sound like fucking big league or anything, but, like, the flair kind of goes on these guys. You realize that they are humans. I don't know if I really feel that way about Mike, man. Like, he might still be a superhero. And, like, I think that after 10 hours of watching it, I'm not sure that it's really any different. Like, this guy reached mythological levels of success, like, to the point where we don't even know what's real and what isn't anymore. But for me, that's almost more fun than if I just did have the absolute cold hard truth. So I don't know. There's just something about a little bit of like a boyish enthusiasm that I felt like throughout all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the same way, but I think, you know, a lot of people wonder why, like, people who are from... I think a lot of people in general are very proud of where they grew up. Not everybody is, but a lot of people are, or where they're from. And I think a lot of people...
You got to rep.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, especially when it comes to Chicago, when you hear somebody, like, say, oh, yeah, I'm from Chicago, like, they kind of say it with, like, a little bit of, like, enthusiasm and swag. You're just like, why are you continuously... I do it all the time. Like, why is this person continuously letting me know that I'm from Chicago?
Yeah.
This is, like, a direct reason why.
Yep.
You know, the last 22 years have not been kind to the Chicago Bulls organization. Nope. But, I mean, when I went to a random Tuesday night game in the middle of January and there were, you know, 15,000 people maybe in the stands of a 23,000-seat stadium and they dim the lights, serious plays, and they run out that really disrespectful lineup of, you know, random players. But even before that, when they play all the highlights of the 90s Bulls and everything, and you look up at the six banners and be like, yeah, like, there's a standard of excellence like that in Chicago is regarding the Bulls. It's not the Cubs and the White Sox, and I know the Blackhawks have had more success than any team in this town the last 10 years, but there's a direct swagger being from Chicago and also being like, not only am I from Chicago, but, like, Michael Jordan loves this town, like, made this town who we are. And, like, this is Chicago basketball because Mike made it. You know what I mean? This is why we think we're the Mecca, right? So, I like, to me, that was just, like, it played straight into that type of, like, this is where I'm from. You know, this is why I'm a Bulls fan. And, like, you know, growing up, not being able to see it and just now being able to see all the behind-the-scenes stuff and get to immerse myself back in it when we're stuck at home and everything has been nothing but a pleasure.
Yep. Uncle Luke, fantastic work, brother.
Yeah, that was fun, man. That was some of the best fun I've had in quarantine, I have to say. No doubt about it.
God bless, man. God
bless. I've been drinking tequila through this the entire time. That's how much fun I've been having. It's midnight on a weeknight, but you know.
you know, that listen, you're willing to put in the hours that the other guys aren't, right? Like Floyd Mayweather used to train from midnight to 2 a.m. because he said, you know what, the other guys aren't working right now, and that gives me a mental edge. So maybe you're the Floyd Mayweather of podcasters.
I'm nowhere gonna compare myself to Floyd Mayweather in any respect, but I appreciate
it. No worries, my guy. Had a great time chatting it up. Great time watching the series. Don't know when we'll talk again. I'm sure there's something we can figure out to talk about. Hopefully we get some news regarding the season, whether it's the MLB or the NBA or
something, anything. More genuine than I need sports, man.
Bro, that pain was so real. So that's all right. I think it's all things considered, we're going to be okay. It'll be here. It's going to come.
And the end's near in more ways than one, but the end is near.
Uncle Luke, one last thing, my guy. Let's go home, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go home.
Let's go home. Let's go home, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go home.